And I can absolutely say I've seen people with 24 packs that look like garbage on the inside. There's so many different measurements of health, but what we have decided health looks like doesn't really have anything to do with how healthy someone is on the inside.
Welcome to the Trailhead of Trail Runner Nation, where we go on virtual trail runs with interesting guests that talk to us about the science and inspiration to help us become better runners and hopefully better human beings. If it's your first time, you are always welcome here. Let's get down the trail.
Today, we're running with Ashley Reaver, and she is an expert at the biomarkers. What are biomarkers? We're going to find out and how they're important to you to be a successful runner.
You can energy. They're redefining energy so you can perform at your peak without those energy hills and valleys in your training and racing.
Leave those hills and valleys on the trail and not in your gut, Scott. And that's what UCAN Edge Energy does for us. If you read the other guys, their foil packages, and on the outside it says take every 45 minutes, but not with UCAN Edge Energy. It lasts 2 to 3 hours because it keeps you level and steady. And that's what you want when you're running.
Right. And we have a deal for you. The first one is the Trail Runner Nation sample pack. You get two of the Edge Energies. You get two of the energy bars. You get two packets of energy powder. You get all of this, Don, for free. All you do is pay $6.95 to cover the shipping. The other one, which I would suggest taking advantage of, is the Trail Runner Nation starter pack. It is one box of the energy bars and one box of the Edge Energy. It's a 20% discount off of an already discounted price. You can find those deals at our deals page on trailrunnernation.com. Don, moisture and friction are the ingredients to chafage, which means ouch. And Exoskin has the solution for that.
There's a lot of things that will take you out of a race, Scott, but one of them that doesn't need to take you out is chafage. And Exoskin helps us solve that problem.
I've been using the new Exo Underwear version 3.1 now for probably 2 or 3 months. And boy, I just really like those as a baseliner. They are so nice. They have 90% fewer seams. The seams are what can cause friction and cause chafage. They have the rapid wicking and drying, which means it pulls the moisture away. They also have copper threads in there, which inhibit the odors and the bacteria that you see in a lot of different garments.
And you can find Exo Underwear on their website. It's under the men's section, but plenty of women wear it too, because it works.
And they offer a 10% discount for TRN members in addition to the already discounted prices on their website. Go to exoskin.us and use the code TRN and you can get an extra 10% off.
Scott, when I think of the trail running uniform, I have to think about Gooder. And you and I were walking across the parking lot just the other day at the trailhead, and you identified a fellow trail runner.
We had the same glasses on.
Right.
Can't remember the name of them. They're the green ones with the green mirrored glasses. And I go, hey, brother. And he goes, hey, I've seen you out here before. We have the same glasses. The nice thing about the Gooder glasses is you can buy a lot of pairs. They're very, very affordable. And they have a new style called the Wrap G. They're really wide and covered. They would knock the wind off. I haven't tried them yet, but boy, they look fancy.
You never fall short on fashion with Gooder. Not only are they affordable and functional, but they look good too. And they've always got new stuff coming, which is great.
Go to our deals page and use the code TRN15, and you can get 15% off your purchase of Gooder.
Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. My name is Don Freeman.
And I'm Scott Warr. And today we're going to talk about what's inside your body and how that inside stuff, and we'll define that stuff a little bit better here, but how that inside stuff can affect your genetic potential and your physical performance. Today, we have Ashley Reaver, who is a registered sports dietitian with a master's in nutrition science and policy. She offers nutritional counseling in her private practice in Oakland, and she's a full-time teacher of nutrition and dietetics at the University of California, Berkeley. And she's also, this is how we got to know her, the lead nutritional scientist at Inside Tracker. And she's going to teach us about what's inside and why that matters.
Welcome to the podcast, Ashley.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Hey, we're going to try to put a little structure to this because we've been known to kind of wander through conversations, but this is an important one, and we're going to get a lot of information, and we want to try to keep it structured. And as a instructor over there at Berkeley, you probably appreciate a syllabus here, so we're going to lay it out how we're doing it. We're going to look at four biomarkers. And
Or five.
We just learned that Ashley's bringing a fifth one because she was torn on just which ones to talk about, so we're going in for all five. And we're going to lead off each biomarker and kind of separate them, and we think about them this way. Number one, is there a gender difference? Is this gender specific? Should this apply to me as a female or a male more than the other? Is it age related? If I'm 20, should I worry about it? If I'm 60, where should I think about it with age and fitness levels? Some of us are out running on the weekends. Some of us are racing for a podium. So we'll kind of characterize each one of them in that case. And then we'll ask her what it is, why it's important, what happens if the level is outside of normal, and then how do we fix it? So Ashley is an expert in this area, and we look forward to hearing about it. Scott?
You know, let's get this thing started with a definition. What is a biomarker, Ashley?
Sure. So it is a marker that can kind of gives us information on your body. That's as broad as you can be. We can have a biomarker in your blood. It could be, you know, your heart rate, your max heart rate during a run, the amount of time you spend in REM sleep. It could be, you know, something that we get from your DNA. Essentially, it's just a bit of information that tells us what's going on with or inside your body.
How many biomarkers are there then? It sounds like there's probably a whole lot.
Thousands and thousands. Yeah. I would say of those, probably what we know about the most physiological markers, like what you can get from a smartwatch, is probably the smallest. There's hundreds of blood biomarkers you could find, and DNA is, you know, we're getting there, but there's still so much we don't know about it. Tons and tons of ones that you could find there too.
It could be as simple as a mother putting her hand on your forehead and saying you have a temperature. I mean, that's a simple biomarker that we've all used or experienced.
Absolutely.
And today what we've done is we have twisted Ashley's arm to come on and talk about what are the five most important biomarkers of all these thousands. What are the five most important for endurance runners? And that's really tough. I know that of the thousands to say, okay, these are five. Remember that there's many, many others, and these are just the top five.
And I will say I've made it easier for myself. I'm not an exercise physiologist, so I'm not going to touch the physiology. I'm also not a geneticist, so I'm not going there either. I'm going to stick with blood biomarkers, which is really what Inside Tracker's kind of bread and butter was, so to speak, before we added in a lot of these other biomarkers.
I'll make it simple for you. We're a bunch of trail runners, and we're currently looking up what those people are that you just described to us. So we're ready to go for a ride.
The only thing that we know that it's inside us is like a gel that we just squirted inside us. That's all we know. So anything beyond that is going to be a little bit of help for us.
Awesome.
Yeah. What's our first biomarker? I think we're ready to roll. What do you have? Let's start off with name it, and then let us know if it's specific to any gender, age, or fitness level.
Okay, awesome. The first one that I think is super important is cortisol. And cortisol, we're kind of familiar with it. It's our stress hormone, but it is a marker that you could test both in your blood or in your saliva. It increases in periods of stress. And if you were to get a saliva test taken, typically that's when you're going to see, you know, I'm stressed right at this moment. My cortisol has increased. Your blood, what it can show you is chronic elevations in your cortisol levels. And typically your cortisol is the highest right before you wake up in the morning. It's something that helps us to wake up, and then it tapers off throughout the day. Importantly, I'd say for cortisol, it's really, really key to get it tested at the same time throughout the day so that if you're trying to compare or see if you've made improvements or if it's gotten worse, you're at least comparing apples to apples. There is not necessarily anything that would make it more important or would kind of change what we would expect normal to look like based on age or gender or activity level. Some of the other markers that we'll talk about there are. But for cortisol, that's something that regardless of where you are in your health span or where you are as far as activity goes, we still want this level kind of to be in check unless we're testing you like the second before you're about to go off on a 50K trail run, and it's good to be a little bit nervous because that can help your body a bit.
So how does cortisol actually help us in any way? And you know, we have certain things that elevate because, you know, our heart rate could elevate because, you know, we have something approaching us, we need to get out of harm's way, or temperature could increase because we're trying to get rid of some bacteria or something attacking us. But what about cortisol? What's the purpose of that?
Yeah, so cortisol is that fight or flight hormone. It is something that our body releases in response to some sort of a stressor. So, you know, evolutionarily, this was a great thing for us to have. If you're walking along and a lion hops out at you, you want this big excretion of cortisol to hopefully either outrun the lion or fight it and win. Good luck to that. Most of us aren't chased by wild animals. Maybe on the trails, that's much more common than regular life, but our body is really hardwired to respond in the same way. And cortisol's main role in the body is it really kicks into gear, you know, our sympathetic nervous system, which is that fight or flight nervous system, where a few things can happen. Our eyes get super focused. Our inflammation levels tend to be pretty blunted. If you're trying to outrun a lion, you don't want to deal with an inflamed ankle. We shut off blood flow to our digestive tract. It mostly goes to our muscles and to our brain because that's what we need to escape that situation. It helps increase our respiratory rate, helps increase our heart rate. And something else that it does is it helps us tap into fuel sources, in particular, our muscles. So cortisol can, especially if you're, you know, really running for long periods of time, it can break down our skeletal muscle. And our skeletal muscle is made up of amino acids. Those are the building blocks. About 2/3 of those amino acids can be converted into glucose. And that glucose is the primary source of energy that your muscles, as well as your brain, wants to use in these high stress, high intensity situations. So, you know, we have our glycogen stores, which I'm sure all your listeners are used to. We have exogenous glucose that you certainly eat from your chews and your gels to get some of that. But in those situations where your body needs more of that, you also can break down that muscle mass to convert it to glucose as a continued fuel source. Our fat, very, very small amount. I won't get super technical, but the backbone of triglycerides can convert into glucose, but it's a tiny, tiny amount. So for athletes, it's something that's really, really important to consider because we do so much work with our muscles in mind. We're trying to train, we're trying to rest them, allow them adequate times to recover. But all of these stressors, if you're also not paying attention to them, are kind of counteracting all of that work that you're doing. And the things that really can increase that cortisol level, there's really four big buckets to focus on. We have mental and emotional stress for sure. These are things that could be real, but certainly our response to them, how we deal with them mentally, has a really big impact on increasing that cortisol level. Amount of energy that we take in. So if you're under fueling, for trail runners in particular, eating enough calories is not something that normally happens naturally. It takes effort and intention to be able to take in enough energy, both within your workouts and outside of your workouts, to have enough fuel to propel your muscles, however far you're asking them to go. Not sleeping enough is another big one, as well as if you have a lot of high intensity activity stacked up one after the other without adequate recovery and rest time in between. Enough time to bring that heart rate back down and to let your body switch from that fight or flight mode into rest and digest, which is that parasympathetic nervous system.
Ashley, as you're talking about this, do you see that athletes are subject to chronic high cortisol levels because they're putting their body into this flight or fight situation more than somebody that, you know, is just a walk-a-day office person?
Yeah, so it depends. It takes a specific type of person to sign up for a 50-mile race. Those typically are more type A people that have a lot of expectations on what they want to achieve and maybe put a lot more pressure on themselves. That probably feeds over into a lot of other things. So type A individuals tend to be more stressed anyways, you know, especially if you're thinking about that mental and emotional stress of deadlines, constantly being on a hamster wheel, maybe feeling inadequate or like you have to, you know, perform to a certain standard. I do think that there's a pretty strong connection there with endurance athletes and just being the type of person that has a lot of responsibilities. But on the flip side, definitely you have to pay so much more attention to fueling, to sleeping, and to getting adequate amounts of recovery when you are, you know, placing these really big demands on your body. So it definitely can be influenced from both sides. And as I mentioned before, just taking in enough energy is difficult. I like trail running. I wouldn't say I've done anything longer than maybe 5 miles, but I have done half Ironmans. And those are, you know, the fourth sport of a triathlon is food, is eating. It is really, really important to take in enough energy and in particular enough carbohydrates to fuel that energy. So it's really easy, especially as your mileage increases, to get just into that big calorie debt that your body can't get out of necessarily if you don't feed it. And just because you don't eat those nutrients does not mean that your body doesn't need them. It will do whatever it needs to be able to find them. And one of those is spiking that cortisol to free up that glucose that your certain amino acids can be converted into.
Before we hit record, you said you had 5 biomarkers to go through. And Scott and I don't know them. And it wouldn't have helped us if we knew them. But you said one of them you have a relationship with, and it was cortisol. And you have a story that you can share with us. So I'm interested in hearing it.
Yeah. Cortisol is really what made me want to work at Inside Tracker. As a dietitian, I've been, you know, very familiar with glucose, with cholesterol levels, with liver health enzymes. But cortisol was the first time that I could actually really visualize what I was doing to myself. And what I mean by that is, you know, as a type A person, I like to say I'm recovering type A. I'd give myself an A minus now. I credit that to being able to visualize my cortisol. You know, I knew that I stressed myself out a lot. You know, I knew that I liked to replay events in my mind all the time, or that I specifically liked to go places that I knew would stress me out. I was a stress junkie. And seeing that cortisol result come back, it was sky high. It was super, super like, what the heck is this? That was the first time that I really saw what my thoughts were doing to the rest of my body. That doesn't stay in your brain. That's a, you know, that those cortisol levels are impacting me just as if I were being chased by a lion for a really long time, you know, because of what I thought before I went to sleep. And that had a really big impact on me and just really highlighting how important these blood biomarkers are. And, you know, we've worked with pro athletes in a lot of different sports, and I love cortisol for young NBA players that we've worked with because they would sit up all night playing video games and nobody could tell them you need more sleep. But when you could see that your, you know, sleep debt or your lack of sleep was causing this spike in cortisol, and then explain that connection to, you know, maybe why they were injured or why they were feeling more fatigued in practice, then, you know, it clicked. You can really get that. So for me, it was a good way for me to break up with being a stress junkie and really take those recommendations of meditation or yoga or just stopping that doom spiral to heart and really put a lot of effort there.
So obviously, Ashley, you don't have to just run many miles and put yourself through physical stress. Somebody can just have a lot of emotional stress and have a workplace that's very difficult or a home environment that's difficult. There's many ways to end up with high cortisol. And then you stack that with lots of running, trying to get away from your stress. And now you have a double-edged sword to deal with. But I was thinking as you were talking, I wonder if Ashley could walk through a group of people and locate based on their actions and their habits and the way they moved around. I bet you that person has high cortisol. Have you ever matched that when you're working with somebody? Do you ever predict markers before they happen?
Yeah, for sure. Especially once you learn about, you know, you just learn people and their lifestyle, things that go into it, how their brain works. I don't typically like to judge someone's health by looking at them, but sure, as I accumulate more information, some people are just like, okay, you clearly fit this mold. And even without knowing that biomarker, I'm still going to encourage them to really focus on some of the things that can cause that cortisol to spike.
There is a certain level, I assume, where most of us should fall within to be normal with our cortisol levels. And we've been talking about going over that, and I want to get into that in a minute. But it just occurred to me, is there a danger of being too low on the cortisol?
Yeah. And that's a medical condition called Addison's disease, where your body just doesn't produce a lot. It's a, I don't know, Instagram age buzzword, this adrenal fatigue that happens. If your body can't produce cortisol, it's a condition. You should go talk to someone about it. Because again, cortisol has good, it does good things for the body. There's a reason that we have it. But a normal person couldn't be so zen that their cortisol level is low.
So is there anything we can do to help move that if we're elevated? Obviously, we can try to get out of the hostile environment. We can make sure we get plenty of rest and we watch our miles. But you're a dietitian, as well as many other things that qualifies you to tell us about this stuff. Is there something we can eat? I know the answer is always dark leafy green vegetables. That's all I knew in my nutrition class. But what can we do?
I would actually argue that dark leafy green vegetables in this case are not necessary.
Oh, good.
If anything, they could take you further away from where you want to be for cortisol. For endurance athletes, again, eating enough calories is hard. It takes a lot of effort. Maximize that space in your stomach with something that's going to give you calories. Eating a big spinach salad is going to take up space and time that you could be using to actually help you reach your calorie goals. And it's surprising, but I, you know, for a lot of endurance athletes, I tell them to steer clear of as many raw vegetables as they're eating. Try and have vegetables that are cooked that have some oil in them, most likely can contribute to calories, but also take up a lot less space in your stomach. Importantly, I would say figuring out which of those four things for you is likely causing, or combination of those four is likely causing that elevated cortisol, and focusing on that. If you know that you're sleeping enough, if you know that you're eating enough, and you know that you have enough rest days planned in there where your heart rate is not hitting that max zone, then it's really time to focus on some of those other stress management techniques that are derailing all of these things. And I like to call those four things like the softer sides of training, because we know that they're important, but they're less fun to do or to measure than, you know, how fast you ran or how many miles you accumulated. And for all of us, it might be different, but really focusing in, being honest with yourself about which one of those you could improve on is the best place to start to bring those back down.
Love it. I'm ready to hear about the next four. Based on that recommendation, yeah. I am a believer in you, Ashley. Let's go to the next one. Which one have you selected that's important for endurance athletes?
Sure. So this one was the add-on, and that would be measuring testosterone or DHEAS levels is something you could measure in women. And these are, you know, primary sex hormones. So testosterone is a pretty easy one to measure. For men, it's pretty consistent. We do also measure it, and females have it as well, just in much, much smaller amounts. But sex hormones in women, especially premenopausal women, are cyclical, meaning that, you know, where you are on day one of your cycle could look very different for that hormone based on day 14. So for that reason, EnzoTracker tests DHEAS, which is a precursor to all these sex hormones for females. And knowing those numbers can also be really important for athletes. Very similar to cortisol, the same things that can cause a spike in cortisol can cause these values to be down. So not taking in enough energy is really key, not sleeping enough, too much high-intensity exercise without any rest and recovery in between, and then that mental and emotional stress. These hormones are super, super important for building new muscle. They're anabolic hormones. They help to take these little building blocks of nutrients and turn them into bigger things like muscles. They help make those adaptations in our muscles to increase, you know, let's say mitochondria for endurance athletes so that we can process energy more efficiently. And they also help to repair muscle damage, which is super important too. And all of these sex hormones are nice to have. They are not required to keep you alive. And if your body is deciding between keeping your heart beating and your lungs breathing, in addition to all of these miles, it's going to sacrifice putting resources towards things that are nice to have. So they're going to keep you alive. That's what your body's going to do. And having lower levels of these sex hormones could be a really good indication that, again, similar to cortisol, something of those four is just really off. You're not giving your body all of the resources that it needs to be able to produce these hormones that can not only help you perform optimally, but also recover optimally and really be able to take advantage of your training, because you're only training to get those adaptations that happen. So if you're not focusing on all those things that also support those adaptations, you're, you know, benefiting 50% from your training, and it's kind of, you know, not really worth doing it if your body can't take advantage of all of the stress you're putting on it.
Ashley, for women, premenopausal women, because it's cyclical, is there a certain time that you should be tested? Or do you just make sure that if you're subsequently testing, that you're doing it at the same point in the cycle?
And Ashley, before you answer that one, just for clarification, Scott, you said premenopausal women, but I think it's cyclical for all women. And clear that up. Maybe I misheard your statement earlier. And I apologize, Scott, if I stepped on your question when it was right.
No.
So straighten that out and then let's hear your answer.
Sure. So postmenopause, there's no longer a menstrual cycle. So we don't see that fluctuation in estrogen, progesterone, testosterone that we would see in premenopausal women. But we test this marker of DHEAS for women in particular because it does not change based on where you are in your cycle.
Oh, okay.
For premenopausal women, most cycles aren't just 28 days, but you know, in the textbook, they should be. So it doesn't matter if where you are on day 1 to 28, that DHEAS level is pretty stable. We did try to require all women to test days 1 through 5 of their cycle, which is really inconvenient and wasn't super popular. So that's why we found this marker of DHEAS. They can still give us a proxy measurement of where a lot of these hormone levels are without putting so many constraints on, you know, removing 5/6 of the month. But for postmenopausal women, these shouldn't fluctuate. They should be pretty consistent no matter what day. Anyways, it's great if you can test on the same day or roughly within the same phase of your cycle, because certainly other things can be impacted as well. Your iron level could be slightly different based, you know, on how much blood loss you have. Your cholesterol levels might tweak a little bit, but they're not massive deviations on like a really big scale like we see with the big fluctuations in hormone levels.
I have a question. That you said men are very consistent with testosterone. And this next question you may push down the hall to your other folks at Berkeley. So maybe I'm unfair to ask this. But is if I'm a female, is there a better time in the month that I should want to be running a race? Is there a peak period if I'm peaking on my hormones, is that going to affect me in a positive way for a race?
Yeah, it can. So your testosterone levels definitely peak right before ovulation. Mm-hmm. You know, if you have women listeners, that's typically when you feel like sexy and daring. That's because you have some testosterone to help you out there. It also increases your chance of fertilizing that egg. So that's a great time to be able to really push yourself in training. Also, too, you know, that's a time when your muscles may be able to have more of those adaptations. Another super interesting thing that happens is after you give birth, women that are pregnant, your hormone levels remain high for a little while. And there are a lot of pro runners that like to really take advantage of those post-pregnancy spikes in hormones and growth hormone and testosterone as opportunities for their muscles to just really, really have a beneficial adaptation phase. Even 6 months, I would say by 6 months, you should, you know, if this is something that people really want to do, you do see a lot of pro athletes that take advantage of that. I should say men are relatively consistent, meaning that, you know, day 1 versus day 14 of the month aren't going to be different, but there's still certainly things that can cause that testosterone level to spike or to come back down, you know, on a day-to-day, maybe week-to-week basis. But for the most part, it's not a consistent fluctuation that we would expect.
You talked about post-pregnancy, you know, hormones that remain elevated. It's almost like the body's gift to the ladies for going through that pregnancy. It's like, hey, you gave up a lot of yourself. We're going to keep these hormone levels high so you can put yourself back together so we can do this again.
Right.
There's a lot of recovery and repair that has to happen after growing a new organ, delivering a new organ and a new human. Yeah. So, you know, your body needs those for sure. And I should say, if you don't feel like running for 6 months after pregnancy, please don't force yourself into it. Right. But if you're someone that wants to get back into it, you know, again, there are some additional hormones that are there that are helping your body, also helped you grow a human and an organ, that you might notice that it's going to feel different probably, but your rest and recovery might also feel a little bit different because you're boosted by those.
So Ashley, if we fall outside of this normal threshold with any of these hormones, what do we do? Is there a risk if we're too low? Is there a risk if we're too high?
So for low is typically what we would see from, you know, kind of too much of stuff, of maybe too much running without enough of, again, those four things that I would consider the softer side of training. Fatigue is a really big one that you can feel, just feeling like a general lack of zest for life, maybe would be a feeling to say it, feeling like you're not recovering as well from your workouts, not feeling excited about your workouts like you used to. And especially if you can have like a biomarker like testosterone for men that you can see where your normal is. You went through, you know, maybe 3 years of just focusing on training and neglecting other things, or, you know, maybe it's a shorter period. It's you go through a really tough training block and you see that big drop in testosterone. It really, really does behoove you to take time off and let your body recover from that, because you're only going to continue running that level down if you don't take the time that your body needs to bounce back from that. And sometimes I think that that can be really helpful for people to see, again, of the type of person that might be a 50K runner, you know, needing to see an objective data point that it's too much for their body. Their brain doesn't want to say it's too much, but seeing those markers in the body can be really helpful. And, you know, testing a couple times over the year can also give you insight into, okay, I know the next time I go through a training block similar to this, this is how I want to make sure I recover. Even if you don't get your blood tested again, it's probably a good likelihood that your body's going to act similarly. So, you know, maybe next time, automatically planning in a week off or a week of cross training or a week of really, really low miles, because you know that, you know, typically that's what your body's going to respond with.
Well, I can see the wisdom of checking out your biomarkers and not using, you know, Instagram posts as a way to measure your efforts and your abilities and the things that you should be doing, because at all times somebody's doing something. And yeah. So we have to give ourselves a chance to recover, rest, and get ready for the next.
Yeah. And I can absolutely say I've seen people with 24 packs that look like garbage on the inside. Mm-hmm. And we are all very susceptible to assuming what health looks like.
Yes.
There's so many different measurements of health, but what we have decided health looks like, it doesn't really have anything to do with how healthy someone is on the inside. And I really like that, again, biomarkers give you an objective view of what's happening on the inside when we are also susceptible to only looking on the outside.
Ooh, that's good. That's good.
John G is turning 10 years old today, and they are giving you a birthday present. That's usually not the way that it works, but they're giving 25% off all of John G's best sellers, including the award-winning AFO Middle Short, known to be incredibly lightweight and fast drying. And it's only through May 31st. So if you're listening to this a few days late, you may not get the birthday sale deal.
But you can still get a set of AFO middle shorts. And that's what I'm wearing right now, Scott, the AFO middle short. And I'm loving that short, and I have the good looking blue shorts. That's the product, John G, that puts together the best fabrics, the best prints, and you set yourself apart from the rest of the people out there running.
If you miss the birthday sale, that 25% off, don't despair, because they're giving Trail Runner Nation members a 15% discount by using TRN15 at checkout. But if you hear this before May 31st, boy, you might as well take advantage of that 25% off. Go to johng.com.
All right, what do we have next? Are we ready to roll on to number three?
Yeah.
Awesome. Okay, so I have ferritin listed as number three. Ferritin is related to your iron. So it's a protein that your body makes in response to your iron stores. And when you test your ferritin levels, again, it's kind of a proxy measurement of your iron stores. Ferritin is a great measurement because, one, it's not something that's going to fluctuate too much. So it's not going to be high because you decided to have a steak and take your iron supplement the night before your blood test. It really takes a long time to change. We like to say it's like filling up a swimming pool with a garden hose. It takes consistent filling of that tank to see your body respond by producing more of this protein. And for athletes, in particular, female athletes, it's a great measurement before something is really wrong with not having enough iron. Anemia would be the condition of being iron deficient, of not having enough of that iron. And typically, we would diagnose anemia when your hemoglobin levels are very low. By the time someone's hemoglobin levels are really low, their ferritin stores have been low for quite a bit longer, weeks or months longer than that. So if we can track when those ferritin levels drop, that's going to help us prevent your body not being able to produce enough hemoglobin. Mm. And hemoglobin is so important for endurance athletes. It's the compound that's on our cells. It uses iron, or iron is, I should say, one of the key components to it. But that's what allows us to pick up oxygen from our blood and transport oxygen throughout our body on those red blood cells. And the reason that oxygen is so important is it's because it's needed for the final step in converting energy that we eat from food into the form of energy that our cells can actually use. So while we're running, that's why your heart rate increases and your respiration rate increases, is because our muscle cells are using so much energy. We have a much higher requirement for oxygen to help in that final step of providing energy for our muscle cells.
Ashley, is a solution if someone is low on ferritin, which is, you said, is a precursor, a good marker of whether they're going to be low in iron, is it as easy as buying a bottle of iron supplement and taking an iron supplement every day? Is that the easy response? And I could say, is that another solution to cortisol or these hormone biomarkers? Can we just take a supplement to fix it?
Yeah, I'll start with the cortisol and hormones. There's some supplements that might help. One is something called ashwagandha that can help for both testosterone and cortisol. If cortisol is high, if testosterone is low. However, you will never be able to take a supplement to make up for not sleeping, not eating, or not training appropriately. There are supplements for mental stress. That's, you know, a prescription that can certainly help with that. But no supplement is going to be able to undo the root cause of why that cortisol is higher, that testosterone is low. For iron, it really depends where someone's iron level is, if it's worth taking a supplement or if it's worth trying to just make some tweaks in diet to boost it the rest of the way. Ferritin is absolutely something that's different based on sex in particular, and age, if you think about postmenopausal for sure. Females that are premenopausal, the iron requirement is almost double that of men because you're losing a fair amount of iron in blood every single month. If you're pregnant, your iron needs are like 3.5 times what they are for a man.
Wow.
Because you're producing a ton more blood to be able to also donate that blood, as well as the plenty of nutrients. You want to be able to increase transport of those nutrients to a baby. So there are sex differences and age differences as far as that goes. Females tend to also eat less iron, less foods that are rich in iron than males, as well as just overall volume. So premenopausal runners that are vegans or vegetarians are kind of the trifecta for people that are the most susceptible to iron deficiency. And an iron deficiency of all of our micronutrients is the most common micronutrient in the United States. It's very rare to be deficient in anything in the US. We're incredibly fortunate as a wealthy country to have access to lots of foods, as well as many of our foods are fortified based on nutrients that a lot of the population was at one point deficient in. But an iron deficiency is something that, you know, is believed to impact up to 30% of people. And a lot of that focuses on premenopausal women that are active and that also, again, follow vegan or vegetarian diets that just are very low in the easiest sources of iron to get from food also.
I think that's really an important statement that you just said, that if you are a vegan, because as we know, that's becoming more of a mainstream diet that people are playing with and experimenting with or doing. And when I was vegan for about 5 years, I was told you probably should take some iron supplements because you're not getting enough in your diet. And I was thinking, okay, well, how much? I don't know. So I just took a little bit. I had no idea whether that was helping or not because I wasn't measuring those biomarkers. So I think that's really, really important and to know, you know, what's going on.
What might I experience if I'm low ferritin? Maybe I'm running out there right now saying, I don't know what I've got. Maybe I have all of these things, but what are some of the things that might show up in my world if I'm low in ferritin?
Sure. So fatigue is definitely one of them. Feeling winded or out of breath, needing to take an afternoon nap. Again, you know, our body, we use iron for tons and tons of stuff, but the one that we would probably experience the most would just be that limited oxygen transport. Again, you need oxygen to be able to utilize the energy in the foods that you eat. And that's why, you know, if you hold your breath for a while, you can die because your systems have no fuel to keep them going. So just generally walking around and feeling like you're in like a mental fog, needing to take that afternoon nap, I think is a big clue. Or when you're walking up the stairs, you know, if you go to Boulder or Breckenridge, Colorado, if you feel like that when you're walking at sea level, you're not transporting oxygen very well. And in your workouts, if you're feeling much more fatigued, if your muscles just aren't taking you where they used to take you, you know, you're getting just way more muscle soreness, or they're just crapping out earlier than you would expect. Those are things that you can feel. And I do want to just circle back to what Scott said about trying out a vegan diet. You can absolutely do a vegan or vegetarian diet in a way that gives you all of your nutrients. I'm very sensitive to people just willy-nilly trying these diets. You know, I'm at Berkeley. I would say your freshman year of college is when most people, if they're going to dabble in a vegan diet, it happens, especially in Berkeley. But there's no education behind considerations right. that you need to make. You cannot just eat raw vegetables and think that you're going to meet all of your needs. You can't just eat grilled cheese sandwiches and think that you're going to meet all your needs. Iron, vitamin B12, as well as vitamin D and calcium are important ones that you need to be proactive about making sure that you're either taking a supplement to meet your needs, or you're utilizing fortified foods that can help you make up that difference, just because those nutrients don't exist in as high amounts in plant foods.
Ferritin seems like a good one to watch. You said it's like filling a swimming pool with a garden hose. Is it also like draining a swimming pool with a garden hose where you can watch?
Not so much unless you give blood. That's a way that you could really tank your iron stores, or if you have like an internal bleed that you can't necessarily, I hope someone finds that.
Yeah.
Another thing that can cause ferritin levels to spike, it's not normal for them to spike, but if you have a lot of inflammation in your body, that can cause elevation in ferritin. And that's because, you know, our body mounts an inflammatory response in order to protect us from something. So if there's a bacterial invasion in our body, that bacteria needs iron in order to grow and proliferate, just like our cells do. So our body, as a protective mechanism, pulls iron out of our bloodstream and puts it into a storage form that requires a lot more ferritin. So you can see a big spike in ferritin as an acute phase protein, meaning like something that your body would just see a big increase faster than like your body could actually accumulate those stores if your inflammation markers are high. One of the other markers on the list, hsCRP, is a non-specific marker of inflammation. And we test that with Inside Tracker. So if you notice that you have a big spike in ferritin and you also see that your inflammation level is high, then there's some other metrics that we would encourage you to look at to get a better sense of whether or not you're taking in enough iron, whether you might be susceptible for iron deficiency. But it's an interesting, you know, thing to say. And people that have chronic inflammation could have chronically high levels of ferritin, even though they're not eating enough iron. So it's important to know, okay, when is this marker no longer as effective? I want to be able to shift and look at this other one. And that one for us would be TIBC. And we provide all sorts of info of, hey, we don't think this is accurate. Look over here because your inflammation levels are high.
You know, we're 3/5 of the way through with this episode. And the one thing that I'm learning, kind of a common thread, is with at least the first three biomarkers is giving your body some rest. That if you're going, and you're just going 100% and you're not giving your body time to fix itself, then some of these biomarkers start flaring up. So I think that, you know, that's one of the takeaways I've gotten already out of this, is make sure that you give your body time to repair.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can't stress enough that the reason you're training is to get those adaptations from training, and you need time off to do that. So you're going to be able to maximize the efforts of your training only when you give your muscles time to actually let those adaptations take place.
So wise.
That's very good. And you know, one of the things that was provided to us, that knowledge piece of, it's just not physical stress, it's emotional stress that you carry around with you. And you need to monitor your emotional stress. And if you're a bit tired, yes, look inside and see what's going on, but look around you too. And look what you're doing with everyday life. Well, I've used to always train this way, but you didn't used to carry that emotional load too. So
exactly.
Give yourself a break and think about it.
Right. You didn't have a mortgage. You didn't have three kids. You didn't have a sick parent while you were also running those levels. And I think that that's super important to acknowledge. And we do tend to put blinders on for those things and think we can just push through. Again, I think that's why it's awesome to have these objective data points of what's going on inside, not just based on how you feel or what you think you can do. This is actually showing you, you know, this is what's really going on.
What is our next two?
Okay, so the next one I was going to talk about is vitamin D.
Mm.
And then I was going to end it on inflammation, that hsCRP marker.
Awesome.
For vitamin D, that one is super key for athletes. It's important for everyone, but in particular for athletes, in particular runners that are putting a lot of force and a lot of strain on their bones. Every time you take a step while you're running, something's got to absorb that force, and that goes into your bones. Vitamin D, over the past 2 years in particular, has gotten a lot of praise, I'll say, for having maybe some sort of function in the immune system. Research from COVID just showing that individuals having lower levels of vitamin D tended to have more severe illness with COVID. And I think people just took that and ran with it. In reality, probably what it was that more Black and brown people are likely to have deficient levels of vitamin D, and more Black and brown people didn't have access to healthcare and they died from COVID. But didn't stop people from mega dosing on vitamin D though. And in this past two and a half years, I think we've forgotten that the reason that vitamin D is an essential nutrient, why we need it, is because it is required for us to be able to absorb calcium.
Mm.
So when our blood calcium levels are low, our body converts vitamin D from its inactive form to its active form, and it acts like a hormone. It then travels to our digestive system to increase the amount of calcium that we absorb, to increase the levels in our blood. You know, I just talked about this with my students today. Literally, your bones are the least interesting thing that calcium does to the rest of your body. They are a big reservoir of calcium. But calcium is also needed to fire muscles. So voluntary muscle movement, so running, is great, but your heart also needs to beat. And your body will always sacrifice your bones in order to keep your heart beating. So if you're not taking in enough calcium, that can be obviously, if you're not taking in enough calcium, that can influence your blood taking calcium from these big reservoirs in your bone, making your bones more susceptible to stress fractures or just injury breakage in general, especially as you get older. But if your vitamin D levels are also really low, even if you're taking in enough calcium in your diet, your body might not be able to absorb enough of it from your GI tract to maintain that blood level so that you don't have to tap into those big stores in your bone in order to maintain the blood level.
Where do we get vitamin D? I see it's on my milk carton. It says vitamin D. Is the cow our source for vitamin D, or where does it come from naturally?
Yeah, so we should get about 80% of vitamin D produced in our skin. So as the sun touches our skin, there's a form of cholesterol in our skin that can create vitamin D. And that can, again, exist kind of as an inactive form until a cascade of events happen because our calcium levels dip too low, that converts that vitamin D into an active form. The other 20% can come from diet. Importantly, vitamin D, I would say, for food sources, there's not a lot of natural sources of it. Dairy has been fortified with vitamin D, I want to say, since like the 1950s or 60s, since they realized that you can't absorb the calcium very well from milk if you're vitamin D deficient. That's why you can find it in most dairy products, at least as far as like milk and yogurt go. They typically don't fortify ice cream or cream cheese or cottage cheese or those types of things. But that's why you find it there. But all of those things do not provide you enough vitamin D to lift you out of deficiency if that's where you are. That 80% is supposed to come from our skin, but for plenty of reasons, people cannot produce enough vitamin D through their skin. If you go outside with SPF greater than 15, your body's not able to produce any vitamin D through that. If you're older, your skin becomes like that process is much less efficient. So if you're over 50 and you wear sunblock, you're pretty close to zero in your skin. If you wear long sleeves, a baseball hat, you're blocking the sun from touching your skin through that shade. You're not able to produce it. So there's a lot of reasons why there are a lot of deficient people. We have plenty of users that live in Southern California or Florida or Texas that are still vitamin D deficient because they never go outside without sunscreen or a hat. And your body just can't produce it in your skin if those things are acting as barriers there.
Ashley, this is one of the biomarkers that I was low on when I took my inside tracker test. And I had no clue. There was no outside manifestation that I was low in vitamin D. And I thought, you know, I get outside and I'm running, you know, 6 days a week. I should be getting enough. I mean, I don't go shirtless, so I'm not, but I go short sleeve. And I was thinking, I'm getting plenty. But the biomarker said, no, Scott, you're not getting enough vitamin D. And as you explained, there are some consequences to that, not being able to absorb the calcium that is needed. And so I used the prescription that I got from Inside Tracker to increase my vitamin D consumption. Just a personal experience that you may not know, you may not feel like you're low in any one of these biomarkers. Sometimes you can, like cortisol or these hormones, but sometimes you don't. And that's why it's so important to get these measurements done.
You mentioned earlier, black and brown people more susceptible. They have to think more about it, or are they more at risk?
Yeah, good point. So if you have more melanin in your skin, it also is, protective against constant sun exposure that very likely your ancestors were exposed to. Individuals that have darker skin tend to have ancestors that came from places with a lot of sun exposure. So if you have more melanin in your skin, it acts as a protection almost to prevent against those UV rays that are just constantly hitting that skin. So darker skinned individuals need more time. Typically, it's recommended for people with lighter skin about 20 minutes in the sun of unadulterated sunshine. Again, the back of the neck is often what's recommended. If you have, depending on the degree of melanin in the skin, so how dark your skin is, then you're going to need more sun exposure. It might be 40 minutes. But if you think about black or brown people living in Minnesota between November and April that are lactose intolerant, vitamin D intake is in the tank. So supplement really is one of the best things to one, give you a consistent source of it, but two, provide enough of that to really lift you out of that gutter of deficiency. Having one glass of fortified almond milk each day is not going to be enough to make up that gap.
Yeah. Well, our body's, as always, pretty smart, designing ways, engineering solutions when things are harsh. And the more we learn and study the body, the more amazing that it really is. And so that's pretty cool.
Yeah, absolutely. Last thing I'll just say is that, how this is going to show up for a lot of people is a stress fracture. Mm-hmm. Which obviously is going to set you back for weeks or months as you recover. In particular, again, highly susceptible group is also if you're not eating enough energy, the likelihood of you getting those stress fractures is only going to be compounded. So a good one to look at, because it can take you 10 minutes at a blood draw that can save you 4 months of being really bummed out.
Yeah, and stress fractures, like a lot of repetitive types of things, if you sense something, get it checked out early, because they only get worse. They're cumulative type of injuries.
Yep.
I mean, there's a serious stress fracture where a rock lands on you and fractures the leg. That's a stress fracture. But there are ones that are from repetitive use that you can look in early and get a quick indication of whether you might be susceptible. So a good one.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, the last one that I have is inflammation. This is the marker that we use, and I was torn if I should do inflammation or muscle damage. Typically for endurance athletes, we tend to have a lot more strain on the joints as opposed to the muscle. Certainly while you're trail running, if you're going uphills or downhills, you're going to be putting a lot more strain on those muscles. But I opted for inflammation just because, if you're running on flat land, most likely your joints are always going to be absorbing more of that stress. And your joints kind of show that stress with inflammation. So the marker that we test, hsCRP, is a really non-specific marker of inflammation, meaning that we can't tell why you have inflammation levels that are elevated. We just know that they're high. So I love all of these experiments that we do, testing people after marathons or 50K events and just seeing what's your body look like. I think that's very fun. But you can see skyrocketing inflammation levels as the body tries to recover from these really intense endurance events. You can also see if you have a nagging injury that you keep you know, thinking if you ignore it, it's going to go away. Mm-hmm. That'll show up in inflammation. You could have a toothache. I could kick you in the shin. Those could be things that also cause inflammation. But if you, again, it's one of these objective markers that you can really use to gauge how your body is responding to your training, setting aside if somebody did kick you in the shin before your blood test. It's, again, one of those great markers, especially for injuries that you are not giving your body enough time to actually recover from. Inflammation is kind of a snowballing type effect. And damaged muscle or damaged tissues, that could also be certainly ligaments and tendons and things like that, accumulate a lot more damage than healthy ones. So you're going to see those inflammation levels continue to increase, which is only, again, going to set you farther and farther away from actually feeling good on those runs again. This is one that we wouldn't necessarily expect, again, a difference with age, a difference with gender, activity level. They could be elevated, but acute inflammation that you typically get after a really tough run or something like that is a good thing. That's not what we're trying to measure on this test. So if we were to test you after a marathon and you had a big spike in inflammation, that should be back down to normal max within a week. That acute inflammation is great. You know, that's a good type of inflammation that sends more blood flow to the areas that need more nutrients, more oxygen to be able to recover and get back to normal. But barring some big type of athletic event, if you were to take a blood test, especially after, you know, maybe an easier week and your inflammation levels are still high, that's a good indication that something's going on, that maybe you need more time off. Maybe you should really consider the type of training you're doing. Maybe it's finally worth going to the PT and looking at that thing that's been nagging you. Though, again, inflammation levels are something that we'd still have a normal level for, even if you're active. Your body should still be able to bring that back down within a normal range within a specific time period after a hard workout.
In your experience, Ashley, do you notice that a lot of these markers elevate simultaneously, or do you notice that one just will go rogue on its own?
That's a good question. I would say it depends. A lot of them do change together as a system. So for example, if you see your cortisol spike, it's not uncommon that we'd see your testosterone tank. If we see your inflammation level increase, it's not uncommon that we'd see muscle damage markers increase, especially based on where this test is. So if we're testing you after a marathon, there's lots of things that are going to be way off track, which is cool to look at. But if you're testing kind of over the course of the season, let's say you want to test a few times over the year, what baseline looks like for you, what it looks like after a tough training block, what it looks like after a week off, what it looks like when you think that you're doing everything right. Again, you can kind of see some of these accumulated debts showing up, slowly increasing or slowly decreasing on your blood work if something in that training and in the life around that training isn't necessarily the most supportive.
Well, that's why it's so important to have somebody analyze your results that understands what an endurance athlete does. You know, you may go in and just take a blood lab somewhere and look at the markers and they'll tell you something, but not the same story that an expert could tell you when they know your background and know how the body responds to this type of activity.
Yeah, and I should have said this for ferritin. In our tests, we have these optimized zones that are developed. So there's, you know, if you go to the doctor's, what normal looks like. And then we have optimized zone, which is normal for you or what is ideal for you. So those are based on your age, your ethnicity, your gender, and your activity level. And I think ferritin is one of the best places to highlight that, because as an endurance athlete, we know that your oxygen demand is a lot higher than someone that sits on the couch all day. But if you go to the doctor's office, you know, for women, deficient in ferritin is less than 11. If you go to the doctor's office and your ferritin is at a 13, they're going to say you're fine. But for you as an endurance athlete, you are not going to feel fine. You know, if you say that you're going to, you know, I'm tired when I run, they're going to tell you stop running, which is not how you solve that problem. So those optimized zones are also really cool because they do change on the type of activity that you do. If I were a strength athlete, my ferritin optimized zone would not be as high as if I were an endurance athlete. And, you know, performance is certainly important in there. If you're an African-American male that does a lot of resistance training, we would expect you to have more muscle damage. So that optimized zone for you is also going to be a little bit different.
Boy, that's great stuff. Ashley, you've been at Inside Tracker for 8 years. Is that what you told us at the beginning?
Almost.
And through that time, you've probably seen a lot of blood labs and a lot of athletes. Do you have any success stories that you could share with us that we'd be interested in hearing?
Yeah, I would say, you know, the ones that pop out to me a lot is, you know, working with CrossFit athletes that are, I would say, peak of the peak athlete that pushes themselves to the extreme day in and day out. And when we first started working with athletes, some of those CrossFit athletes were some of the first ones that we worked with, where blood testing was still pretty new for any athlete. Well, I won't go down a rabbit hole, but we also worked with like the U.S. cycling team, and they had plenty of resources and had never had blood testing for their athletes done 7 or so years ago, at least the team that we had worked with.
Wow.
But some of these CrossFit athletes, like, again, I think that for me, what is really rewarding is being able to put together all of the other things in your life that are just as important as what you're doing in the gym. So athletes that have muscle damage that is off the charts, cortisol levels that are through the roof, really high markers of just general health things that they wouldn't expect. Because looking at them, again, you would think that they're the epitome of health. They have 97 muscles coming out of their stomach. But it's really, really great to be able to show them how taking that step back is only going to help them go further. And one athlete that I really have in mind really struggled with rest days. So even though they were forced on her at one point, because, you know, looking at this objective data, it was clear that her body needed rest days. Taking those rest days was really stressful for her. So that also increased the cortisol that we were hoping to bring back down with those rest days. And I do think that it just takes trusting in people that they really have your best interest in mind. They're not trying to sideline you. You're not going to get kicked off a team. But it's nice, again, for people that are much more resistant to making these changes. You know, you've done it, people that have done the same thing their whole life and it's always worked for them. Having, again, those data points that can show, you know, I didn't know this number back then, but I know it now and it's clear that this is not working for you, really is helpful for being able to change someone's like perspective. And, you know, I think for a lot of athletes, you know, we're superstitious. Every single race, I'm going to eat the same thing. Or, you know, I know I don't want to do this because last time I did this, I, you know, had to poop on the trail or whatever it might be. But being able to have some of that evidence, that hard evidence that can convince athletes in particular that a change is really necessary is super rewarding. I think probably just because athletes are more stubborn.
Ashley, thank you so much. This is fascinating. And for me, it's somewhat a new topic. You know, we've talked about periodization and speed training and all these other aspects of running and endurance sports. And either we didn't know or we forgot, or for whatever reason, we're not concentrating on what's happening inside. Sometimes there are manifestations outwardly. Stress fractures or exhaustion, fatigue can be an outward manifestation of some of these things. But sometimes there's not. And I think it's just fascinating to me that there's just a simple solution for this. And Inside Tracker has provided that solution. And not only is it, you know, we've done ads for Inside Tracker. Not only do they do the blood draw and show you where you fall as a normal endurance athlete and where those thresholds are, but they take it to the next step and say, okay, let's pick these three things to focus on and improve. And with your lifestyle, here's some options. And you go through the menu of options and say, okay, I think I can do this, 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 and this to help improve those biomarkers. And then it holds you accountable for it. And I just think it's a brilliant solution. So we appreciate your scientific background to bring that into this whole solution.
Absolutely. I would say for athletes too, you don't want to go to the doctor and be told to stop doing something that you love. So if there is an in-between of this is how you can continue doing that for as long as possible. I really love working with athletes through Inside Tracker because of that. You know, this is something that could have sidelined you, but we caught it. Now we can pivot. So it's not something that sets you back really far or makes you have to stop whatever you're doing indefinitely.
You're in private practice in Oakland, California. Do you still have room for other patients or new patients, or is that something you offer?
So I am dropping it back a bit as I have a full-time job. And I'm also Inside Tracker's lead nutrition scientist, but I do see clients. Particularly, I do work with a lot of athletes for fueling. But yeah, I would say it's not my primary thing. I reserve a couple of hours per week to do it because it's a passion. Yeah.
If you want to learn more, she has a website, ashleyreaver.com. That's reaver.com. And you can read more about Ashley and some of the services that she offers.
Thank you for the plug.
Well, it's the least we could do for the information. So we appreciate you and what you shared with us today.
Absolutely. It was fun.
So grab your biomarkers, put them in your bag, know what they are, improve them, and go out and run.
Mas. And now we've reached the end of the podcast, really the finish line, Scott, where we give high fives as we're coming through the big arch. And we're going to thank our executive producer and editor, Ryan Warr.
And our social media guru, Yana Gibalova.
And our website graphic engineer, Katie Burke.
We also want to thank the Patreon supporters. If you want to become one, you can go to our website, hit the Support Us tab, and you can sign up on our Patreon channel. We also want to thank our business Patreon member, Doug Crumley. Doug Crumley is a coach for your finances. He is a private wealth advisor with Crumley & Associates, which is a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, LLC. When you have the right financial advisor, life can be brilliant. Visit him at www.dougcrumleyjr.com.
Scott, we mentioned the deals page quite often. That's on our website, trailrunnernation.com. And we've made a lot of changes there, and we're really proud of it.
There's a lot of information there. Of course, there's the deals page where you can get all sorts of discounts on gear that we love and trust. We also have all of our other podcasts. We also have the training principles link. So we just started the training principles episodes at the beginning of this year. All those are kind of organized in one area. So if you're just getting into trail running and want to know the basics of where to start, go to the training principles tab. You can also sign up for our newsletter. We don't fill your mailbox full of junk every week or twice a week. Only when there's important things to happen, you'll also be notified when a new podcast hits the air.
So go to trailrunnernation.com.